I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. In a conversation about the headwaters of American thinking and this catchword, transcendentalism. It's an exaggeration, but only a little, to say, as Susan Cheever does, that the best of American literature can all be traced to five houses on three streets and the space of about 10 years in a single town in New England, not a university, not a church, but an open circle of enthusiastic geniuses who charge each other up and egged each other on. Their important product includes Hawthorne's novels, Emerson's essays, Whitman's Leaves of Grass, Thoreau's Walden, Melville's Moby Dick, and eventually Louisa May Alcott's Little Women, among many other things. The one name that encompasses all of it, whatever else it means, is transcendentalism. Not a philosophy, but a sort of energy, perhaps an attitude. It's a subject dear to the heart of Open Source and wonderfully reanimated in spirit and flesh and ideas by our guest Philip Gura at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. His book is American Transcendentalism. Philip Gura, you uncork something very powerful here, very American, very much alive today, I think. But what is it?
Chris, thanks for having me on the show. What is it? It's a very important philosophical movement that has a lot more tentacles than just those books that you mentioned. We're really talking about one of the first serious intellectual coteries in American history, talking about people who were interested not only in writing novels or essays, but really who understood that even by that time America was not particularly on the right course and they wanted to begin to change it. So we have people working in the abolition movement. We have people working for women's rights. We have people helping the poor and indigent in Boston. Really, to associate it merely with those Concord authors is to miss the larger story, I think.
You know, before we get into them and it, I just want to note that in this 2008 presidential campaign, it's fascinating to me that people are thrashing openly around issues of faith. What is it? Faith in what? Where does it belong in the public life of a nation? They are, in a sort of tattered version, the transcendentalist questions, aren't they? I mean, and they're also questions that don't get argued in the great politics of other nations. You can't imagine it in France or Russia or China or England or Chad, for that matter. Is this part of that inheritance?
Well, what we have through the transcendentalists really is a kind of opening up of the American religious experience. I think if Emerson or Theodore Parker or George Ripley were observing the present campaign, he would be shocked at the doctrinaire ways in which religion is still thought of in this country. Really, everyone seems to have to testify to a certain kind of creed or faith. And if anything, transcendentalism wanted, as the name suggests, to rise above that, to feed on some impulse from the spirit that really was universal in nature and was not bound by any particular kind of creedal statement. So I really think there would be a good deal of, not just amusement, but really almost disgust at how straight and narrow these individuals were presenting themselves.
Why? Is that because the transcendentalists were naturally unorthodox?
Well, really what they had was a kind of spiritual version of the attitudes developed during the War for Independence. What kind of religion should America have if people are created equal, if we really are claiming there should be equal rights for all? This faith, which was so democratized, was the perfect counterpart for it. The trouble is that, in fact, during this period when they arose, like the country was being shattered into various Christian denominations, many of which are still with us today. They rejected that. They really wanted to claim that whether you were a Baptist or a Methodist or a Unitarian, you really were still feeding off the same spiritual impulse that floated, in a sense, as Emerson called it, that oversoul that floated through us all, and which we could access at different times, you know, if we only would get away from the mundane cares of this world. That's what it would mean to transcend, to rise to this point where you really were influenced by something higher. You might call it conscience. You might call it intuition. Emerson called it the reason with a capital R. That's what should direct us. We don't have people talking about those sorts of things except perhaps in the most liberal church organizations today.
It's fascinating to read the Emerson generation, they are saying controversial things, but with tremendous equanimity. They're not at war with anybody. You wouldn't know from reading even Emerson's Divinity School address, in which he, which was his sort of last act as a Christian preacher. I mean, it was his exit from the church as such. You'd never know that he was he was making controversial news. There's an equanimity, there's a non-sectarian confidence about it. How do we explain that, and how did that pass out of the conversation?
Well, he didn't want to make any trouble, but he certainly did, as you know, from the brouhaha that followed the Divinity School address. But in really, Chris, the kinds of things he was saying there and the kinds of things that Theodore Parker said in a famous sermon on the transient and permanent in Christianity were amazingly unsettling for anyone who was a regular church person. The Divinity School address essentially claims that Christ is not the Son of God because he's special, but that he's the Son of God as we are, all sons and daughters of the deity. That's still pretty radical news today to a lot of people. So I think that the kind of openness, the kind of cosmopolitan vision that these transcendentalists had and that they wanted to impress on the nation as the national faith really had a hard time because of the increasing provinciality of the country as it became more interested inwardly in its problems, particularly, I think, the problem over slavery. So the faith never had a chance to sort of find a large audience because it got sidetracked into these other activities.
Certainly the conversation on the campaign trail today, winning the base, sounds remarkably literal and sectarian.
Well, you know, these people wanted to win the base, too. And my students are amazed to hear that when I assigned a thorny Emerson essay that this production actually was first spoken in a lyceum or in a meeting house. I think people were simply used to a more high level of discourse and really took this as their intellectual fodder. You know what the sound bites sound like today. Our attention span is 4 or 5 seconds. These people sat for an hour and a half through an Emerson lecture that would be published in a famous book of essays.
It made him famous. It made him not exactly rich, but it supported his life.
Indeed. And one thing that I stress in this volume, and I think we should get to it fairly soon, is that really he is only one voice among many, as I began by saying a few minutes ago. We really, when we're talking about the transcendentalism movement, we're talking about a kind of germ that spread, that grew in different ways in different individuals. For example, one of Emerson's closest friends was Margaret Fuller, a pioneer feminist. She understood that if you were listening to Emerson, he was talking about women as well as men, and she began to bring that message to the women's rights movement, one of the most radical voices in it at that time. Bronson Alcott, Louisa May's father, took the germ into the schoolroom and started an experimental school in Boston called the Temple School, in which he taught youngsters under 12 years old by Socratic dialogue. He taught them about the deity. He took them out into nature and showed them the kind of correspondences between the natural world and the spirit. So we really have a kind of sophistication here that today I think is very rare, whether it be in fields like education or even the women's rights movements and other reform organizations. The larger message they had really is resisted, not so much because of its complexity, but I think because of its radicalism.
There is a calm and an equanimity here in the midst of intense controversy. How did they keep their cool so?
Well, I think they really saw what they had as a kind of panacea for what they saw in the nation at that time. Really, what was happening religiously in the United States was what was called the Second Great Awakening. We had a great proliferation of doctrine, a great proliferation of religious excitement that was expressed through different denominations. And these people were saying, you know, whoa, why split into these groups? There is, in fact, a universal sentiment that unites us all. This will calm things down. This will bring us to that point where we really understand what the Spirit is. And again, we seem very far from that in our own discourse today, our national discourse about what faith is. They did not want to impose faith on someone. They simply assumed that it grew from within when you understood what your spirituality was truly like. And again, as I said, we don't hear many voices in that particular pitch today. Now, I want to just remind your listeners that this really did begin very strongly as a religious movement. And its first leaders were ministers, not just Emerson, but names I've mentioned, George Ripley and Theodore Parker and Orestes Brownson, a name I haven't invoked yet. These people really were the key early players, particularly Ripley and Brownson. And Emerson got into the game a little later. So what you find in these first figures really was a kind of translation of this sense of the inner grace of each person to the outward world, to an attempt to reform what they saw as very, very severe economic and secular conditions for the populace, particularly of the Boston area. Then when Emerson comes in, he begins to stress much more this notion of the individual reform. And this is a split that persists, I think, for many, many years, even after the Transcendentalist group begins to break apart. Do you take your kernel of faith and allow it to grow into something which is, in fact, a kind of effort at humanitarian reform, or do you take it instead and build yourself, build your own world, as Emerson said very famously? And I was surprised to find in the research that, in fact, although these people remained certainly on friendly terms, there was considerable debate about where Emerson was taking the movement. The great minister, William Ellery Channing, even suggested that had someone else, and he mentioned a man named Frederick Henry Hedge, had someone else emerged to move the group, it would not be so individual-focused as it finally was once Emerson became its leader in the late 40s and early 1850s. So again, what I think happens later on is we begin to associate the movement primarily through this notion of individuality and self-reliance, when in fact, particularly in its incipient years, it was an attempt at a much larger kind of reform that really had the public good in mind.
That whole invocation of self-reliance and the idea that, you know, you must follow the gleam in your own mind, the inner voice, has a certain tension built into it with two things. One, orthodoxy and the scriptural tradition or any other tradition, and two, the social community. I mean, Emerson was famously not a joiner. He didn't go to Brook Farm to work together. He was not a movement kind of guy. But in what senses was that very individualism? I don't want to say egotism or solipsism, but was that Emerson individualism sort of controversial?
Well, I think it was. In fact, Elizabeth Peabody, another important woman member of the group, called his faith egotheism. In other words, making himself a god, and there is a correspondence between her and some other members that really suggest that's the danger, that someone really comes to believe that there is that kind of empowerment, and one tends to forget that the work still is indeed among those who are not yet converted. So that really, you put your finger right on it. It's a tension, I think, that persists in our own democracy today. For example, when you have a social problem, is it because there's a moral failure in the individuals who are within that problem? Or is it something which is systemic and can be taken care of by those who reach in and help those who are in those dire straits? We still argue about this in our contemporary politics.
Do you see Emerson that way, as a relatively conservative or at least not activist individual thinker? Or not?
I've come to appreciate him in a little different way. Again, I was surprised by the resistance some of his ideas received, particularly before the mid-1840s. But I must admit that by the time of the Fugitive Slave Law and the other difficulties of the 1850s, he really comes on board and begins to speak out quite strongly for abolition. What happens really, Chris, I think, is that after the Civil War, as different of the chief members of the group begin to die off or begin to move into different careers, Emerson and Alcott really are the only ones left who seem to represent that early fervor of the movement. So that individualist side, in a sense, begins to get stressed very strongly, particularly in the later 19th century and obviously after his death when he's so canonized. What happens, though, is that the full complexity of what he was saying about what an individual must do for himself gets lost or gets put into this little capsule called self-reliance, so that Andrew Carnegie and others can say, you know, Emerson was important to them to build up their sense of self-esteem. Well, it wasn't just self-esteem. It was a kind of self-esteem that really was there because you understood with humility that you were part of a spiritual universe that was much more immense than any one individual. So in a sense, we have a kind of simplification of the message and then a popular notion that little message is what transcendentalism was at its core. It's much more complex than that.
Yeah, keep pushing on that. It seems to me my Emerson, and I love the man, is an extraordinarily gifted writer about the spirit. And he does – I mean, people say to me today, you know, you can't be a Christian and be an Emersonian. I say, you know, hold your horses. Emerson is a marvelous believer in the reality of spirit, the pursuit of the ecstatic, the inward, the invisible, the mysterious, the divine. That's the all-time Emerson for me. And it's not simple at all.
No, it isn't. And I think, you put your finger right on the situation here. In the famous Divinity School address, he really talks about the miracle being in the blowing clover and the falling rain, not in some sacrament that's being transformed from bread into the body of Christ. It really is everything around you. And that's a pretty hard message for people to accept unless they come to a certain degree of enlightenment of the kind he was talking about. Again, what amazes me is that people genuinely seem to want to take him whole. They wanted to read his essays. They wanted to hear him. And there was this yearning for a different kind of understanding of what the religious life was. I think that the great national tragedy over slavery begins to suck out the energy of that transcendentalist group, so that message began to get lost. And as I suggested, when we come out the other side after the Civil War, we have this kind of this overblown notion that it's only the individual who matters. And I think if you ask 50 people on the street, 48 would say that's what Emerson means to them.
Interesting. What does it mean to say Emerson lives or transcendentalism lives, Philip Gura?
Well, it lives in several ways. It certainly lives still in some religious circles. That is, I think, the Unitarian Universalist Association, which now really enshrines people like Emerson and Parker as among their putative saints, continues to have this very open notion of the religious life. They're willing to incorporate different kinds of faiths into their worship services. They're open to all kinds of individual notions of the spirit. With Thoreau, we certainly have him alive in notions of civil disobedience. Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and others certainly took inspiration from his famous essay on civil disobedience. But with him, perhaps even more now, as one of your previous guests, Lawrence Buell, talks about, he really is a progenitor of the modern ecological movement. He saw nature in certain ways that really are only coming home to us today in the complexity, the connectedness of the natural world that we seem to be breaking apart. Thoreau leads us right to that. In women's rights, I mean, I think Fuller's radical critique of woman's place, that it wasn't just outward things like a job or a vote that had to be respected, but the integrity of the inner person, the woman as a whole being, just like men were being considered at that time. These are still very powerful notions, I think, in our own culture. So it's with us, and I hope it's not there just in that kind of simplified, diluted form that I mentioned that is often associated with the kind of afterglow of the movement and Emerson's influence.
Philip Gura, can I just say, historians look for beginnings and ends. I feel about these men, and Margaret Fuller for that matter, and Louisa, a tremendous continuity. When Thoreau writes about the vitality of this moment and the greatness of people around him, simple people, as important and as insightful as Shakespeare or Homer, when Emerson talks about the universal mind and the notion that having read Plato, you are Plato, I mean, I think these guys speak for all time. Mm-hmm. And they resonate. It seems to me, I could tell you about my own sort of discovery of Emerson as a radio talk show host, but it seems to me every time, in every sort of public discourse, in the good ones anyway, there's a kind of thrill of Emersonism very much in the air.
Yes, I think that the kind of openness to different ideas, open source, so
yes.
to speak,
yes.
was present in the Emersonian circle as well. No topic was off the table as long as people treated it seriously and as long as people respected each other's ideas. You know, one of the main ways this disparate group organized was in these various conversations, as they were called,
yes.
some led by Margaret Fuller, some led by Bronson Alcott, in which a topic would be introduced and then essentially a couple hours long dialogue would be taking place until everyone had had his say. This is the kind of thing we don't see very often in our public life today. We simply don't have coteries of intellectuals. Perhaps what you're doing, what you're attempting in these kinds of radio presentations brings us close to that, particularly now that people can actually respond in terms of getting back to you by email or other means. In that sense, that conversation does go on at the same level that the transcendentalists wanted it to.
You know, but people don't have to be too self-conscious about it. They don't have to know Emerson at all. It seems to me it is in the air somehow that people listen. They listen to the other guy. They want to speak. They want to speak with some passion. They are intensely interested in those realms of the invisible and the inward that Emerson writes about so skillfully, among others. I think that's the real – I mean, I guess I feel that's the real America.
But you may be talking still about – just as they were, a coterie. I think if you went into a restaurant, if you went to a tavern, and really wanted the people to get what they believe off their shoulders for you, and then heard what you said, there would be tension, there would be worry, there would be a kind of judgment going on, which was not happening in the transcendentalist circles. I mean, I think you're talking about the converted, just as they were talking to each other. Look at the uproar Emerson and his cohort caused among their elders, among the Unitarians. These were their parents, these were their teachers, and yet they couldn't talk to each other. They were throwing darts at each other for years over these questions, even though that group was supposed to be the most enlightened Christian group at the time. So again, we're talking here about spreading the faith, but sometimes it's threatening to spread that kind of faith. It's dangerous. People worry about putting themselves on the line in just the way you're discussing.
It may be easier to watch a football game, but I don't know. I think the football games drive out a lot of those more speculative conversations that people still love to
you
have.
You say they yearn to have, but that's the question. I mean, we're talking about people now, your host, your listeners, who really take this as part of everyday life. This has to be right now a very small population.
Humble, but growing, and very, very lively, I would say. Philip Gura, there got to be personal stories here behind your own 40-year investment in transcendentalism and these people. I want to know your story.
I mentioned it in the acknowledgments to the book. I really have been thinking about this literally since an experience I had in November 1963, the month that we all remember for the dark days in Dallas. I was walking in the woods near my home in western Massachusetts and saw an astonishing group of birds in a tree. They were huge. They were yellow. They were garrulous. They were eating choke cherries. I didn't know what they were. I was a little kid. What does a kid do? He goes to his public library and asks for some kind of field guide. Well, Peterson's field guide, which I came to know later, was not in on that visit. So the librarian and I thought, why don't I just describe these birds and write to different museums, tell them what a great discovery I had made. She obviously was encouraging my interest. And I wrote to the American Museum of Natural History, to the Museum of Comparative Zoology, to the Smithsonian, handwritten scrawl describing my wonderful birds, and nothing happened. And then about 3 or 4 weeks later in the mail came a handwritten envelope from the Museum of Natural History. And the note said, "Dear Philip, these are undoubtedly evening grosbeaks, a large cousin of the goldfinch, signed Dean Amidon." And I looked in the book that had come back to the library, and they in fact were evening grosbeaks. And years later, I realized that Dean Amidon was in fact one of the foremost ornithologists in the world, and he had taken the time to answer my little query. which got me deeper into the world of nature and then finally into the world of Thoreau. For years and years, I kept journals of my observations of nature, of observations of self. And when I went to college, it seemed natural to begin to move into the field of American literature and American history. And even though, as the children of immigrants, I sort of claim these people as my own, I think that's what you were talking about earlier. There is something quintessentially American about these people. They fascinate us. They seem to represent something about our past that we want to get to understand better. And that's certainly what happened with me in this. And literally, as you say, I've been doing writing about this group for several decades.
Emerson said, "I will be a naturalist." And he felt a kinship with the caiman and the carp, as he said. You're right. You're right in the mainstream of that history, and I didn't know it. That's fascinating.
Well, interestingly, for example, think about Thoreau for a few minutes here. We see him now as a great social prophet, as a person who criticized the detrimental economic system that he saw emerging through industry. When he was first published in the later 19th century, when the journals were published, he was presented essentially as a nature writer, an observer of the natural world, and the journals were edited in such a way as to delete those very powerful social comments that he was making, and he fit the bill better in the 1880s and 90s as someone who was out there floating on the river looking at birds. It took us a while to recover the fullness of his message, and I really am trying to do the same kind of thing in this volume. There were so many voices at so many different pitches, and I want to sort of get that symphony going again in people's minds.
You say in the acknowledgments of your book at the very end, Philip Gerard, that you and a variety of other scholars and students and writers have your own, you call it a little bit shyly, transcendental club. And I want to know how to get into it. Robert Richardson, among others, Joel Meyerson, Larry Buell. What are the qualifications for this group? And are open source listeners entitled to apply?
Well, the best way to find out about the club is to read the wonderful scholarship of this group. And there's one more whom you didn't mention, David Robinson. We all had associations through the Modern Languages Association, the famous MLA, as it's called. And we used to meet at the convention each year and sort of have a transcendentalist club dinner. We really talked about doing a collaborative history. We all have different interests. You know the work of most of these people. It would have made a wonderful book, but we tended to go in our different directions, and I finally decided to sort of take the bait and try to do it for myself. But it really is a very informal group, and I'm again, not kiddingly, if you want to know what the transcendentalist scholars are thinking, read their wonderful books, and that'll be the handshake through which you enter our world.
Yeah, but what is the connection here? Other than love of inquiry, enthusiasm, love of American history, love of nature.
You mean why do we focus on this particular group?
Yeah, in the Transcendentalist Club, how do you know one when you see one? What do you talk about? What are the passions here?
Well,
what are the questions?
The question, we have to decide really what did Emerson mean about becoming a transparent eyeball. That's the secret one you have to answer. You know your Emerson as well as I, and you've been quoting him wonderfully today. No, I think it's the membership simply revolves around the fact that we really do believe these people, as you began by saying, offer some kind of key into American cultural history. It really hasn't been turned all the way in that door. We want to open it. We want to get the news out about these individuals so that really this kind of openness that you talked about, this Catholicity with a small C that they represent, really comes back into the wider conversation. The club is really just a little joke among us. There are no minutes taken. We simply get together to appreciate, as you and your listeners do, the complexity and the vibrant writing of these individuals.
Well, it's a token to me of what's hugely alive in this tradition. I've written and said on the air before that, I mean, Duke Ellington was for me the Emerson of the 20th century, and his band and the larger jazz family is the successor to transcendentalism in their toughness, in their seriousness, but their popular dance hall short form, long form, variety of individual voices within the whole enthusiastic regime. I mean, this model of a kind of collective enthusiastic inquiry that is always trying to refine its understanding of spirit and mystery is the transcendentalist urge, and it's out there forever, I think.
Yeah, you know, and the one thing, though, that gets challenged so much, I think, in our own time is the notion that really, to be a transcendentalist, you have to have some notion of something higher, something that is, in fact, transcendent. And I think that particularly in the academy, some of these writers we're talking about have gotten a bad rap because of the fact that, in a sense, they're representing spirituality in an age when that really has gone out of favor. If we think about Marxist criticism, if we think about post-structuralism, why should we still be thinking about what our soul is like if we really are entering those discourses? So I think, again, we're still talking here about a real opposition, not only in general society, but in the academic world about what the value of these people really is. I mean, we're talking about it as though it really is religious and spiritual. We talked a bit about their influence on literature, but there are people who would say, you know, we've moved beyond that. We don't want to get tangled up in that anymore. This is, in fact, a secular world. So, you know, we have to, in a sense, maintain their position and keep something, in fact, divine about our everyday experience. It's pretty hard to get this message spread with any, you know, with any larger hope. I mean, think of Thoreau's business about, about the interconnectedness of life. Read the papers any day. We're just breaking the place apart. I mean,
yeah, that's true for sure.
See, if it's the fountainhead of an American religion still, who are its voices? You know, yeah. I just, you know, you mentioned Harold Bloom, of course, all the time, and Stanley Cavell thinks these people are fantastic, but, you know, there aren't people on street corners converting people to transcendentalism.
I think you hit the nail on the head. If there's a core, it's the notion that spirit is real and that mystery is infinitely attractive and that we've got to find new ways, maybe in music as well as language, to wallow in it, to thrive on it, to deal with it. Philip, this is so interesting, and your book is too.
Thank you, Chris.
We could go on forever, but let's call it a day with thanks to you and a reminder that the book is American Transcendentalism, A History by Philip Gura at the University of North Carolina. Thank you, Philip.
It's been a pleasure, Chris.
And let's keep the conversation going.
We'll be listening. Thank you.
Paul McCarthy produced this conversation. Open Source is recorded at the Watson Institute at Brown University. You can subscribe to our podcast free at the iTunes Store. You can visit our website at www.radioopensource.org and join the conversation yourself. I'm Christopher Lydon.